thinker or one who perfects the plan. Maybe you're at one end or other of the spectrum or somewhere in between. When I worked for Surrey Police, one of those personality tests that you can take had me down as somebody who would pay great attention to detail. It was just as well because it was an important part of my role as a performance analyst. But it also had its lighter-hearted moments because on many occasions I would be chatting to my colleagues at their desk when just glancing at the report they were writing on their computer, I'd suddenly break into whatever sentence I was saying and I'd say to them, "You've got a typo there." I'd just spot it out of the corner of my eye. It was there. I would suddenly stop. Without trying, from 10 feet, I could spot a typo. And yet if you gave me that report to proofread, I'd be much less likely to notice it. It happened so often that my boss thought I was ill. Did I ever do it to you, Andy?
Probably.
Probably once or twice, yeah. But it's important, isn't it, to be able to see both the big picture and the detail. If you were writing to someone with whom you had had a strained relationship and you were trying to build bridges by saying, I look on you as a friend now, but accidentally omitted the letter R from the word friend, the relationship might take a little bit longer to repair, mightn't it? The detail is vital. I just chose a name at random. Or if, as a nature lover, you're so focused on appreciating the intricate beauty of individual plants around you that you miss the stunning view beyond, you miss out on something special, don't you? The big picture, as well as the small picture, is important. It can tell you something about your wider context and where you are heading, which the fine detail might not be able to tell you. And so looking at a whole long chapter can give us the chance to look at the big picture as well as the fine detail that we often tend to focus on if we just look at one or two of these stories or parables at a time. So what do we pick up from our reading of the whole of Mark chapter 5 that we might otherwise overlook if we only looked at one of those three encounters that we read? What are the common threads that run through each of those three stories of Jesus healing somebody who's very needy and, frankly, quite desperate in each case? Many of us are familiar with the stories. The spiritually sick man living in a graveyard who nobody could restrain and who was constantly self-harming. And yet Jesus comes along and gets rid of his demons. They ask to go into a herd of pigs instead, and the pigs run headlong over a cliff and drown in the lake. Or the synagogue leader, Jairus, who was desperately concerned for his 12-year-old daughter, who was at the point of death, just as she was reaching what for them was adulthood. And the delay that meant that the girl died before Jesus reached her, and that he had to, instead of having to heal her, he actually had to raise her from the dead. Or the story of the woman who caused the delay, who thought, "If I can just touch Jesus' coat, I will be healed." And so she did. And she was. And Jesus noticed the power go out from him. So he delayed his mercy dash to the dying girl and gave attention first to the woman. "Who touched me?" he said. "What? You're in a crowd of like this and you ask, 'Who touched me?' That's like a Six Nations rugby player in a scrum saying, 'Who touched me?' Everybody did." The woman knew what he meant. "It was me," she said. "Go in peace," says Jesus. "Your faith has healed you. Be freed from your suffering." Three brief encounters with Jesus. But what are the common strands in each of these three stories that emphasize something special for us. Well, first of all, we see that in all three cases, the individual concerned approached Jesus, or someone approached him on their behalf. Verse 2, when Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an impure spirit came from the tombs to meet him. Verse 22, then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. And verse 27, when she heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his cloak. Jesus was approachable to them. His reputation as a healer had gone before him. There was clearly an expectation on the part of Jairus that he could heal his daughter, and on the part of the woman that he could heal her. The story of the demoniac is a little bit more ambiguous, because although he runs out to meet Jesus, his demons then take over and beg Jesus to leave him alone, to leave them alone. But actually, if you think about it, if those demons really wanted Jesus to leave him alone, they'd have kept him in the cave. I just get the impression that they were not fully in control, that there was still something about that man's own personality that overcame his spiritual difficulties and made the first step towards approaching Jesus before the demons took the story. There was still a bit of him in there as he desperately approached Jesus for the help that he needed. And then there's another really important aspect of these three stories that tells us just how approachable Jesus is. Commentators point out that in each case, Jesus allowed himself to engage with people who would in his society have been classed as unclean, and therefore not to be touched. And if you did touch them, you became unclean yourself, and you had to go through certain rituals before you could play a full part in society again. The demoniac lived in a graveyard. For a Jew, contact with the dead or with graves made you unclean. The man who rushed out to meet Jesus was about as unclean as you could get. The woman's medical condition made her perpetually unclean in Jewish society, with dreadful consequences both for her and her family and her social life. It's no wonder then that she chose to try and approach Jesus secretly, without being found out, and that she was fearful about being found out when he realized what had happened. Somebody has taken power from me. And by the time Jesus reached Jairus' daughter, all he had to work with was her lifeless body, contact with which in Jewish society and Jewish law is one of the main sources of impurity. And yet in each case, Jesus allows himself to be exposed to these three different sources of impurity, and he works through them and despite them. It reminds us that whatever our consequences, our circumstances, however dirty we might think we have become, for want of a better phrase, Jesus is approachable. Indeed, he longs for us to come reach out to him so that he can touch our lives and clean them up. Jesus is approachable. It reminds us that Jesus chose to leave the perfect riches of heaven for the filthy, broken, sin-contaminated poverty of this world so that he could touch our lives and offer us redemption and a new start with God. And as we'll remember when we share communion in a short while, it reminds us that Jesus went about that task by taking our sin on his body, on the cross, by surrendering to the power of death, so that we could know God's forgiveness and the hope of a new life with the risen Jesus as he then defeated death. And then it's worth noting how each of these people greet Jesus. Verse 6, when he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and fell on his knees in front of him. That's the demoniac. Falling on one's knees was a sign of acknowledging authority in that culture. These days, it's more often a sign that you've just scored a goal and you're seeking the adulation of the crowd. Or perhaps if you've been invited to the palace, you're being honoured with by the queen. But it's worth noting in our story that at this stage, when the man bows on his knees before Jesus, at this stage, it's the demons that acknowledge Jesus' authority. He shouted at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In God's name, don't torture me." For Jesus had said to him, "Come out of this man, you impure spirit." And Jairus similarly bowed down before Jesus. Even though he was a synagogue leader and had an authority of his own, he realized that he was in a situation where he needed the help of a greater authority. Verses 22 and 23, when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet and he pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." And the sick woman did just the same. Verse 33, after she had touched his cloak and after she had been healed, and he had asked, "Who did that?" We read, "Then the woman, knowing what had happened, came and fell at his feet and, trembling with fear, told him the whole truth." And so the spiritual forces of evil acknowledged Jesus' authority as God's son. The human authority of a synagogue leader acknowledged Jesus' authority as the author of life. And the fearful humility of a healed woman acknowledged his authority as healer. In fact, this whole chapter is about the authority of Jesus to deal with any situation he encounters, if only we will allow him to. And I want to highlight one small piece of detail in this story that points us towards that bigger picture of Jesus' authority. When I was first preparing for this evening and reading the chapter through, I was deeply struck by three small words that stood out in verse 19. Remember, the demon-possessed man has just been healed by Jesus, and his many demons had been allowed to enter a herd of pigs, which had been spectacularly thrown off this cliff into the sea. And understandably, the man who had been healed wanted to follow Jesus as he departed for his next destination. Verse 18, as Jesus was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed by demons begged him that he might be with him. That sounds reasonable, doesn't it? You or I would want to do exactly that, probably. But then we read Jesus' response, and it sounds like a complete rejection. In the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible, it is just three words. "But Jesus refused." I think in the version we had, it was, "But Jesus wouldn't let him." But Jesus refused. It doesn't sound like a very Jesus-like response to a request to follow him, does it? So why would Jesus refuse the man's request to go with him? Reading on, we're told that he then said to the man, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and what mercy he has shown you." And we read that the man then went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis, that's the 10 cities in the region where they were, how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed. And so in giving him that instruction, Jesus gave him his call and purpose for his life. And perhaps something similar happens in the other stories in this chapter. Put yourself in Jairus' shoes for a moment. You have a 12-year-old daughter who is dying. The emergency ambulance that you've called for and which is on its way suddenly stops and switches off its blue lights, and it stops because the driver has seen somebody who's been sick for 12 years and been managing somehow, but has suddenly been healed as you rush past her. And you stop and find out what's going on. She's not even sick anymore. What's Jairus thinking? I can only imagine. Your daughter's lying at home, dying. What on earth do these people who are meant to be helping me think they're doing? It doesn't make sense. And looking from the outside, even the woman's story doesn't entirely make sense. If you or I went for healing ministry, we might want the full works. We might want Jesus to lay his hands on us and to say a few authoritative words of prayer that spoke directly into our situation and maybe gave us a little bit of insight for the future. And we might want to sense the Spirit's life-renewing power flowing through our body, putting right what had gone wrong. Well, it looks like this woman got that last bit, at least. But the rest she just got from a mere touch, and not even a touch of Jesus, just by touching his clothes. But perhaps she was the person in the story who grasped the extent of Jesus' authority most fully. She had faith that just getting close to him, just touching the hem of his cloak, even, could result in her healing. A refusal, a mere touch, and even a fatal delay. They don't sound like very promising circumstances in which to see God at work, do they? And yet Jesus used them all for God's glory. Even though at first glance they seem to be less than God's best for the people involved. I wonder, does that describe our situation sometimes? Do we sometimes feel as though God has fallen short of our hopes and expectations to bless us? Were you expecting him to allow you to do one thing which you thought was the logical way to follow him, and he pointed you in a different direction instead? That's how Pauline and I first got to know people here 13 years ago when we were exploring my call to ministry. We thought we were meant to be going in one direction, and God had other ideas. It went via Slough to Dedworth. Are you expecting God to respond to your crisis as if an emergency worker responds to a 999 call, only to find that he seems to inject a fatal delay in his answer to your prayers that eliminates hope? Or are you struggling with the idea that you may simply need to reach out for the slightest, seemingly insignificant touch of Jesus to address your problem when you were looking for a spectacular, all-singing, all-dancing solution to your problem to tell people about? The fine detail of these stories in Mark 5 reminds us not to allow our expectations to limit God, because we never know what he might be about to do instead. God's able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine. So when we pray, when we ask him for things, Actually, we need to give him the freedom to use his authority to go beyond our prayers in his response. The thing is, if we're going to acknowledge somebody's authority, we need to allow them to exercise that authority, don't we? It's no good going to the doctor for his or her expert advice about how to get well if we don't then have the prescription that they've given us made up by the pharmacist. And it's no good having the prescription made up if we don't then take the medicine because we don't like the taste of it. And it's the same in our relationship with God, because he knows what's best far better than we do. God does not always meet our hopes and expectations, but he does exceed them. Isaiah 55.